From the studios of EWTN, this is Open Line with today's host, Father John Trigilio. In North America, call toll-free 1-833-288-EWTN. That's 1-833-288-3986. Outside North America, call 1-205-271-2985 or send an email to openline@ewtn.com.
A tremendous Monday to each and every one of you. Thanks so much for tuning in to EWTN's Open Line. Father John Trigilio is in the house, ready to take your questions. Pick up the phone and give us a call at 833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number, 833-288-3986. If you're outside the United States and Canada, that number is 1-205-271-2985, and we'll even put you straight to the front of the line at 1-205-271-2985. You can always send us an email. That email address is openline@ewtn.com. I'm Jack Williams, Michael McCall producing the program. Your call screener is Matt Gubensky, and your social media maven is Ace McKay. If you're watching us on YouTube or Facebook Live, if you're not waiting for a Tyrannosaurus Rex to attack Father Trigilio from behind, then you can type.
I don't know where that came from.
then you can type a question into the chat window, and it may find its way to us by the end of the program. Father Trigilio, what in the world are you doing over there?
I'm looking for Fred Flintstone and Barney Rubble. I want to have to say hello to Mary Jane Danner from South Bend. She's a dear friend of Monsignor Michael Hines, who's our academic dean here. And he said she's a very avid, faithful listener to our show.
Oh, well, thank you so much for listening. We certainly appreciate that. We're going to break from tradition before we get to the emails today, Father Trigilio. I've got a caller who's been holding on from the last program that I want to give us the opportunity to accommodate, if you would be so kind. Pete is a first-time caller. He is in the great state of Nebraska, listening on Spirit Catholic Radio. Pete, your patience is being rewarded. You're on with Father John Trigilio.
Yes, I have a question about 1 Corinthians 15:35. I was listening to a Protestant protester pastor talk about it, and it was confusing. And I'm just wondering what the church's position, or what exactly it is, how you would put 1 Corinthians 15:35. I can read it if you want me to.
That would be awesome.
Very helpful.
but someone may say, how are the dead raised? With what kind of body will they come back? So it's talking about the resurrection, glorified body.
Mm-hmm.
And so, is it a literal body or is it a spirit body?
Okay, that's a good question. We believe, as Catholic Christians, and we certainly reaffirm every Sunday and Holy Day, when we do the profession of faith, the creed, we believe in the resurrection of the body. We believe that the physical body that you and I have will be resurrected just as Jesus resurrected from the dead. He will resurrect our bodies, but that will happen at the end of the world, at the second coming of Christ. The dead will be raised, the general resurrection, and then we have the general judgment that takes place, and then the end of the world. Now, it's going to be more than just a resuscitated corpse. So it's not going to be something like from Michael Jackson's Thriller video with Vincent Price. It's not going to be like Zombies and Dawn from the Dead, where people pop out of the graves and look disgusting and horrible. It's going to be like Jesus on Easter Sunday. He had a real body. It was his body that he used and lived for 33 years here on earth. And then after his death on Good Friday, he rose from the dead. It was a physical resurrection that took place. And that body, though, was glorified. And we see that it's real. It's not a ghost because he eats food with his apostles. And he says to Thomas, touch my hands and my feet, my side, and see that it is I. So we believe that we will have the exact same kind of body as Jesus did. Now, the difference is going to be those who ended up in hell, they will have their bodies resurrected, but they will not be glorified. They will be immortal, but they will suffer pain, and they will be miserable, and they will be ugly looking. But those who've gone to heaven or will be going to heaven, they will be glorified to glory, and their resurrected bodies will be beautiful, agile, no pain ever. They will obviously enjoy immortality. So we believe in more than just a moral or mystical resurrection. We believe in a full-blown resurrection from the dead. But as I said, there's going to be a little bit something, I should say a lot different, and a lot of improvements, a lot of upgrades.
I hope that helped you, Pete. And actually, if you go and continue to read the remainder of chapter 15, it pretty much lays out just what Father Trujillo stated. So that'll be a little extra resource for you. 833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. Wide open phone lines for you at 833-288-3986. Michelle says, hello, Father Trujillo. I want to ask you about my parents and my sister. They haven't been to church in years and not gone to confession either. What can I do to help them come back to the Catholic faith?
First and foremost, pray. Pray every day for them. Pray a rosary for them. Do some little tiny, and I mean tiny, talk to your spiritual director or your confessor about a very small mortification you could do either every day or maybe once a week for that intention. And then every now and then, without you becoming a pest and annoying and harassing them, because it'll have the opposite effect, every now and then, invite them and say, you know, I'm going to confession this coming Saturday, and, you know, if you'd like to go along with me, and then we'll go to Mass and then go to dinner afterwards. At least you made the offer, you made the invitation. Now, I would especially do this in Advent, and especially in Lent, when these are the very typical times that people think about going to confession. If they say no, they say no. But you got to ask. I just wouldn't want you to do it every single chance you get, because then they'll say no just because you're bothering them. But I would not avoid asking. But in the meantime, pray every day for them. But remember, Jesus said no prophet is without honor except where? In his own house. So you may not see the fruit of your labor, but hopefully you'll be planting a seed that maybe somebody else will see have great abundant fruit.
833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. It's a free telephone call anywhere in North America. 833-288-3986. Kyle wants to know, how do I defend Mary's perpetual virginity?
Well, her perpetual virginity is certainly a dogma of our faith. We believe, and it's in the Catechism, Mary was a virgin ante, inter, and postpartum, which means before, during, and after she conceived Jesus in her immaculate womb. We believe this because, first of all, the virgin birth is part of the prophecy of the Messiah to lend great support, corroborative support, that he is the Son of God, because he had no human father. If he would have had a human father as well as a human mother, his origins would be more less credible. But the fact that he was born of the Virgin Mary, we certainly believe that he has his true human nature, but that he has no human father, obviously re-supports his divine nature. Mary having other children, obviously there's no real evidence of that, even though people say, well, it says in the scripture, his brothers and sisters. Remember, that's an English translation of the Greek word adelphoi, which is the plural of adelphos, which, yes, it can mean brother or brothers and sisters, but it's any male relative. And we see in the book of Genesis, where it mentions Abram and his brother Lot. Well, Lot isn't his blood brother. Lot is his brother, who is Haran. It's his brother's son. But in ancient Hebrew, they didn't have a nice word that we have now called nephew or uncle. So you had to go the long way around and explain, oh, well, that's his brother's son, or a more inclusive word, which we would say in English, relative. Now, if Jesus had these relatives or even half-relatives, they would be vying for control of the church when he died. Where were they Good Friday? Why is Mary all alone except for John, who's not her biological son? So obviously that shows us that there is no other son than Jesus.
833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number, 833-288-3986. It's Open Line Monday with Father John Trigilio.
This is Open Line on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. If you have a question, call 1-833-288-EWTN. That's 1-833-288-3986. Outside North America, call 1-205-271-2985. Or send us an email to openline@ewtn.com.
You know, EWTN's religious catalog honors the United States of America with patriotic rosaries, miraculous medals for the military, devotional Immaculate Conception houses and garden flags, neckties, keychains, devotional candles, books, DVDs, and a whole lot more. Buy Catholic, shop EWTNRC.com today, and you can receive regular emails from EWTN's religious catalog. Just visit EWTN.com and click on subscribe. 833-288-EWTN. That's our toll-free number. Wide open phone lines for you at 833-288-3986. Andrew asks, how can I prove to someone who is not a Catholic that the early Christians really were Catholics?
Well, we can show that by the process of the via negativa, which is something that the scholastics, especially St. Thomas Aquinas, used a lot, by showing how the contrary is wrong and false. When we look at...
So it's not first century fish fries?
Because what would you call them? Okay, there was no split in Christendom within the Christian religions until the East-West split, which took place in the 11th century, around 1056. There was no separation. You had Eastern Catholics, you had Latin or Western Catholics, but they were all together as one body. You had some heretical sects that were removed from the church. The Arians were left, the Monophysites and others. But no group said, oh, we're equal to. That division, the main division that took place in the 11th century when the Orthodox, basically Greek Orthodox and then the Russian Orthodox split from them. And then, of course, in the Western part of Europe, we're one body until the Reformation, when Martin Luther Halloween day, October 31st, 1517, posted his 95 theses on the doors of the cathedral there. But there was no, they were identified as Christians, and they were all under the jurisdiction of the Bishop of Rome. He was recognized not just as a first among equals, primus inter pares, but that he was the successor of St. Peter. Now, they obviously may not have had the same oversight managerially as we would have in the Latin Church, but Christianity was basically one, and that's why the Church is always praying for the return to unity, not just among the various Christian denominations in the West, but also between the East and the West. So there is no parallel group of Christians other than Christians.
833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. 833-288-3986. 3986. Pick up the phone and give us a call. Laura asks, how can I better understand the church's teaching on no salvation outside of the Catholic Church?
Well, that's a good question to ask, because there's an extreme interpretation that the church condemned. When a Father Feeney got on the radio and basically said, if you're not a card-carrying, registered Roman Catholic, you're going to hell. The church says, we don't believe that. However, it's true, the statement, ex ecclesia nulla salus, outside the church there's no salvation, when you understand it properly. There's a wonderful document, Dominus Iesus, that makes that, spells it out. It's also in the catechism. It's been the consistent teaching of the church. We're not saying that only Catholics get to heaven. What we're saying is that, and Pope Benedict made this extremely clear when he was Cardinal Ratzinger, and again when he was Pope Benedict the 16th, that salvation comes through Christ, and Christ and his church, because the church was founded by Christ. The church is the extension of Christ, is his mystical body. So everyone who is saved through Christ and saved through the church, and some may not be completely aware of it. The only ones who are in a pickle are those who know that Jesus is the one way of salvation, and that they know the church is necessary, and they consciously, deliberately, knowingly, and freely reject that. But there's a lot of people who don't realize that. So anyone who's operating on what we call invincible ignorance, aren't aware of this, they're not going to be held accountable or liable for what you don't know. But that puts onus on us who do know to share the faith, to say to people, look, here's the fullness of truth. We have sacred scripture and sacred tradition. We have the fullness of grace, all seven sacraments. And we have the fullness of authority. We have the Petrine ministry and the apostolic ministry of the bishops in union with the Pope. So, yes, we need the church. The church is necessary for salvation. But there's some people who are unaware of that, and yet they are still saved, not in spite of, but because of the church.
833-288-EWTN, that's our toll-free phone number. If you've got a question for Father John Trigilio, anything at all about the Catholic faith, perhaps you're wondering where the church comes down on this whole notion of the Bible alone or faith alone, perhaps you're in dialogue with a non-Catholic and they've asked a question that you don't quite know the answer to, or perhaps you yourself are a non-Catholic and you want to know about Catholic teaching A, B, or C, this is your opportunity. Pick up the phone and give us a call, 833-288-3986. Tony wants to know, why does God expect and want us to have faith when it is uncertain and can be prone to error?
Well, it's not that the faith is prone to error. It's what, because faith is trusting completely on what has been revealed to us by God. Unlike knowledge, which is something that you and I have certitude about, because we know, like, for instance, you know 2 + 2 = 4. Once you understand that, you will always know it. You don't believe or have faith in 2 + 2 = 4. You have knowledge. And yet, there's a lot of things that we don't understand, but we have faith. Like, when you go on a plane, unless you know aerodynamics, or you studied and took training as a pilot, you may not understand how that plane gets up in the air and then lands in another place, and it can do that all the time effectively. You have faith. You trust in the pilot. You trust in the airline. And now, certainly your faith can be dashed when you have faith in that your luggage is going to get there on time. I've had that happen. But when faith in God, faith in his holy church, basically means I trust that this being, God, or this institution which he created, the church, all right, has the authority, will teach those necessary truths I need to know. And I don't need to understand, because if I understand completely, one, it's no longer a mystery, and two, it's not faith. It's knowledge then. So the faith is, it's not violating reason. Fides et ratio, faith and reason, means they work together. A lot of times people think, oh, faith contradicts, or it's antithetical to reason. No, reason is limited because we have limited intellects. We only know so much. Faith is huge because it's based on what has been revealed to us, and God, who is infinite, reveals all the truths that he knows we need to know.
833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. Put Matt Gubensky to work. Give him a call at 833-288-3986. Kristen writes in the Nicene Creed, what does it mean when it says that Jesus is consubstantial with the Father?
Okay, that's a love. I'm so glad they tweaked the missal and particularly the creed, because when I was a youngster, when I was in high school seminary in 1976, we had the phrase one in being with the Father, but consubstantial is a more accurate. One in being was not wrong because it was approved by the church, but Pope Benedict had that tweaked because the Latin consubstantialem, where we get the English word consubstantial, means of the same substance. Back in the Council of Nicaea in 325, there was the heresy of Arianism that said that Christ was similar to, had a similar nature to God the Father, but not the same. So the Greek word was homoousios, whereas Nicaea said, no, it's homoousios, which basically means it's the same, not similar. So Jesus isn't a hybrid. He's not like God. He is God. He's the second person of the Trinity. And therefore, this is a solemn teaching of the faith that was certainly first put into a full effect at 325, but it's been consistently taught again and again and again.
833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number, 833-288-3986. Straight ahead, we're going to talk to Sam, we're going to talk to Eddie in Texas, Mary in Idaho, and we've got plenty of time for your calls as well at 833-288-3986. Real quickly, Father, Daniel wants to know what the Catholic Church teaches about gambling.
Well, like anything, you have to avoid the extreme, which would be to be addicted to gambling. You have a gambling addiction. You're being imprudent. You're squandering your money that you need for food, and you should be saving for your retirement for health purposes, especially if you're head of a family or you've got responsibilities for people at home. But if it's just entertainment and you're doing it legally, and you're doing it under certain prudence, it's entertainment, okay? We have guys who play poker at the seminary. They maybe do it once a week or once a month. They play for pennies or nickels, okay? And after an hour or so, they're done. That's not an addiction. But I have some relatives who went the other way, and they're playing a lot more frequently, using lots more money, and it would get violent or nasty, and or they got people that have, we say, bent noses, if you know what I mean. That would be an extreme. But just like drinking alcohol, there's some people who should never drink alcohol. There's some people who should never gamble. There's other people who could do it very properly, prudently. But again, it must always be evaluated again and again, in the same way that, your consumption of alcohol should be examined. So we're not per se saying that all gambling is evil, but some people can do it wrongly, or it can be used by people who know other people are susceptible to it, and that would be wrong.
833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. Straight ahead, we're going to talk to Sam in Greenville, South Carolina, Eddie in the Republic of Texas, Mary in the great state of Idaho, and I want to hear from you. That number's 833-288-3986. It's EWTN's Open Line Monday with Father John Trigilio.
This is Open Line on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Back to the phones we go. Next up is Sam, a first-time caller. She's listening in Greenville, South Carolina on Catholic Radio in South Carolina. Sam, thanks for holding. You are on with Father Trigilio.
Hi, Father. I wanted to know, I'm a lifelong Catholic. My husband and I love our Catholic faith. We have a huge family, and we live in an area of the country that has a lot of married priests. It's never been explained to us why these Anglican priests were allowed to be married and then become Catholic priests. We feel like if you want to be a priest in the Catholic Church and married, why not be Anglican first and then somehow cheat your way into the Catholic Church? We also don't know. We're also not really sure why. What can you do? Do you have to be celibate if you're a married Catholic priest, or how does it work? It just seems like you went through the back door, kind of illegal, and now you can have it all. You can have your cake and eat it too.
Yeah, I mean, it can appear that way, but we have to be very careful because, one, it is approved by Rome, and this is why. The Anglican priests are not validly ordained as Anglicans, so they need to be ordained for the first time in our perspective. In the secular world, it'd be they're being ordained again, but we say that first one was invalid. When they were ordained an Anglican priest in their right, they're allowed to marry. And when they become Catholic, if they are already married and then become Catholic and they're already an Anglican priest or Episcopalian priest, Rome has allowed them and even some Lutheran ministers who are married to come into holy orders as a married man. Now, we go back to the ancient practice that is certainly still in effect in the Eastern Catholic Church, in the Eastern Orthodox Church, that marriage must precede holy orders, so that if a man is ordained as a single man, he cannot marry. But if he's married, he can be ordained, obviously as a Byzantine or Eastern Catholic Church or Eastern Catholic priest. In the Western Church, it's by exception, because since the Council of Elvira, around 306, 309 AD, celibacy became normative in the Western Church. It was always optional in the Eastern. And then it became mandatory in the 11th century, okay, when in the West every priest was expected to be celibate. That being said, the Church allows for, it's a dispensation that we ordain married men in the Latin Church if the priest coming or the man to be ordained is already married and he's coming in from another faith. Now, it looks like he's coming in the back door, but that would only be the case if the guy was Catholic and it said, well, I'm going to be a married Catholic priest, so I'll become Lutheran or Episcopalian, get married, and then become Catholic. You can't do it that way. You must have been a Protestant Christian from the beginning. You can't be a Catholic, become Protestant, and then come back in. They won't let you do that. We have a priest in my diocese of Harrisburg. He was a Jewish rabbi. Then he became evangelical. And then he was ordained a Catholic priest. He's married because he was married prior to his ordination. There are not a lot of them. Now, in the Anglican ordinariate, you've got some married clergy. But the married clergy cannot proceed any higher. They cannot become bishops. That's true in the Orthodox Christian Church. It's true in the Catholic Church. This is that episcopacy must be for those who are celibate only. So when it happens, it's not going to be the common thing in the Western Church. Our rectories aren't designed for that. We're certainly not paying these guys enough to support a family. It is by exception, but in those cases where it's happened, I see they're very good holy priests. They're doing both jobs very well. But it's not going to be normative because that's not part of our tradition here. It's not just doing a disservice. Many times they don't make them pastors because of their family obligations, so they help out as an assistant or they have a special ministry like a chaplain to a hospital or they work at the chancery office.
And at least one of the first 12 priests ordained by Jesus himself had a mother-in-law, huh?
Yes, and we never found out what happened to Mrs. Peter, just that St. Peter had a mother-in-law who got sick, and then Jesus cured her. I don't know how happy St. Peter was. It just said it happened, and I'm just wondering. I would love to have known the expression on his face. That'd be a great picture for somebody to paint, you know, Peter's mother-in-law being cured and then the look on his face.
How's that, Sam? Does that help at all?
Well, and then the follow-up, is there anything where I thought if they were a married priest, they had to be celibate when they became a Catholic priest?
No, they do not. There is an ancient practice. It's not mandatory where in the Eastern Church, Eastern Catholic, Eastern Orthodox, that the prior to the Divine Liturgy, the married priest should abstain from conjugal relations with his wife the day before. That's a common practice among many of them, and that's not because it's anything sinful. It's just like, you know, when we give up meat on Fridays, it's not because meat is sinful. It's just an act of self-denial for a higher purpose. But that's the only thing I'm aware of. Otherwise, they're certainly allowed to remain married and take the privileges that are attached to that.
833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. Next up is Eddie in the Republic of Texas, and he is listening on Sirius XM Channel 130. Eddie, you're on with Father John Trujillo.
Hello, Father. Hey, my question was, I recently was in a discussion about whether or not Christians should be cremated, and we got into talking about the body, which led to another discussion about body tattoos, excessive tattooing of the human body. But mainly I'd like to know the position of the church on cremation, whether it's okay, and then the other one led into the tattoos. So if you could kind of clear that up for me so I could explain it better.
Sure. The catechism makes it clear, and it's also mentioned in the funeral ritual that the priest or deacon uses when they bury someone. Cremation is permitted under the provision that the person who died has not denied the belief in the resurrection of the body. That's why when someone's cremated, they are not allowed to have their ashes scattered. Even if they wanted it, we have to say no. They can be cremated, whether it's for health reasons, like during a time of pandemic, or for economic reasons, they just can't afford a regular funeral. But the cremains must be contained completely and then buried in the ground or buried at sea, but not sprinkled, not scattered. They're not scattered over the water. They're not scattered in the woods or anything like that. They're not allowed the wind to blow them to the four corners of the earth. And worse, this practice people are taking now where the living survivors take a spoonful of their loved one's ashes and take it home with them. No, no, no. And you don't put them on the mantle in the fireplace. You don't keep them in the closet. I have many friends who are undertakers, and they say, do you know how many people never pick up the ashes after the funeral? That's not right. So if someone's cremated, it should be under the understanding that they're not denying the resurrection, because obviously after centuries upon centuries, you're going to be dust anyway. So God's going to be able to resurrect you. We just don't want people showing a disdain for the body because it is going to be resurrected. That's why, you know, we allow for cremation under that provision and how you treat those ashes. But I've seen so many bizarre things where people do that. Now, going to tattoos, it's the same principle. Tattoos are not intrinsically evil, but they can be if someone goes overboard and imprudently has them all over their body. They're distracting or they're offensive. They're showing disdain for the body. My dad had an anchor on his arm. I say it was only little after he, you know, got old and it shriveled up. But he got it because he was in the Navy and he fought World War II when he was in Korea as well. I found nothing offensive or immoral about that. But when you see people having tattoos all over their body, some things which are anti-Christian or they're too secular, they're obscene, or they're just distracting. And certainly, you know, we want people to dress properly when they come to church. So if you got tattoos all over yourself, cover them up when you go to Mass. I can't stand when I see people with bizarre things. You know, I saw one person about a year ago had a semicolon tattooed on the back of their neck. Now, there's nothing sinful about a semicolon. I mean, maybe they were an English teacher at some point. But people ask, what is that? Now, I'm not saying you should have a crucifix or the Virgin Mary, but I've seen very tasteful Christian tattoos. I'm not saying I would ever get one of those. But you have to use prudence and common sense. So, yeah, it's not forbidden, but don't go hog wild on it either.
We head next to the great state of Idaho. Mary is listening on the Ave Maria Radio app. Mary, thanks for holding. Welcome to the program.
Hi. So my question has to do with being sacrificial, being able to offer things to God, and in general that, you know, we baptize Christians.
Hello?
Well, we lost Mary, oh. Unfortunately. Mary, call us back, please.
She was sacrificed.
Yes, she was. Margaret is in the great state of Michigan, listening on Sirius XM Channel 130. Margaret, you're on with Father Trujillo.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My question today is, when does the soul leave the body? Especially nowadays, there's research done that artificially keeps a body alive. While the research is being done, and then at the end, they obviously remove the person from life support. So when, Father, does the soul leave the body?
Okay, that's a very, very good question. The soul is the principle of life, so that a person is theologically, metaphysically, morally dead. All right, when their soul leaves the body. Now, when does that exactly take place? We don't know the exact moment. As a priest, when I'm called to anoint someone, I'm not allowed to anoint a dead body. I can bless a dead body, but I can only anoint a dying person or someone who's seriously ill. I can anoint. Sacramentos sunt propter hominem, as St. Thomas Aquinas said. Sacraments are proper for humans, not for corpses. That being said, if I would go to some place and someone's been dead for a while, I look for three things. Putrefaction, where the body begins to smell because they're dead. Remember Martha in the gospel? Surely, Lord, there'll be a stench. She's been dead for 4 days. So you got putrefaction. You have rigor mortis, that the body has stiffened up because of death. Okay. And you also have no sign of life whatsoever, no spontaneous imminent activity. If those all three are present, then we say, okay, the person is dead. But when the exact moment, it's not like on TV or the movies where when they flatline and there's no brainwave activity, that's when medicine may say you're dead. But we don't know if once the soul leaves the body, then the body becomes a corpse and it starts to decay, go back to, remember, man, thou art dust, unto dust thou shalt return. We don't have a very precise moment. That's why if the body's still warm, it's not cold, if rigor mortis hasn't set in and there's no stench, I can conditionally anoint someone. But once they're ice cold, once, you know, all those other consequences are there, then I have to say, okay, I'll pray for the dead, I'll bless the body, all right, but I cannot anoint a corpse. Medicine, in ancient medicine, you were dead if you stopped breathing. Well, we know that you could stop breathing and still be alive. They said you didn't have a heartbeat anymore. You could still be alive and no heartbeat. Now, if you're artificially kept alive, if you are alive in the sense that the soul is keeping the body alive, in addition to the machines that are working, like the respirator and other things like that, the soul's still in there. But can science do something beyond that? I don't know. All right. Because certainly when we were in biology class, when we were kids, high school, seminary, I remember we were running electricity through dead frogs and watching their legs move around. We didn't bring them back to life. That was just a stimulus and a reaction. So where the exact place, there's a little bit of ambiguity. But certainly science is allowed and encouraged medicine to find as close as they can. But I don't say with metaphysical certitude, oh, well, the doctor says, you know, they died at such and such a time. They may not be, all right? So if they're still warm and, you know, within a reasonable amount of time, 15 minutes to half hour or so, they might still be alive, and I can anoint them. So I don't want to give it a precise moment when we don't have it, but we also don't want to go to either extreme.
Father, you'll be happy to know I ran out and I found Mary in Idaho. She is back. Mary, you're on with Father Trujillo.
Yes, he came and found me. I don't know what happened. Sorry. So the question is about offering things to God in general, you know, like we all do, but especially our priesthood. Anglican friend of mine is telling me that the sacrificial priesthood, like offering Mass, is something that crept in later, was not part of early theology, that it was wrong, and that the Anglicans, because they don't do that, they've got it right. So, yeah.
Well, he got it wrong. I mean, sacrifice is an essential part of the priesthood. It's not the only part, and I would encourage everyone who's watching or listening to read Pope Benedict's first encyclical, Deus Caritas Est, because he shows that divine love, which human love must model, is both sacrificial, okay, ablative, and also possessive or receptive. It's give and take. God the Father offered us, gave up his only begotten Son, but he also receives our love, our worship, our devotion, and the same with Christ. So the priesthood is sacrificial, but it's also receptive. We receive from the people the gifts that we use at Mass. We receive their faith and then present it to God the Father. But Jesus Christ is the high priest, and St. Paul talks about, you know, this whole idea of the priesthood is different from the Christian priesthood is different from that of the Old Testament, which was hereditary. The priesthood of Christ is based on the order of Melchizedek. Melchizedek is in the Old Testament. He was a king and a priest. He offered sacrifice of bread and wine. All right. So the essence of priesthood, yes, is sacrificial. It's more than just being a rabbi. A rabbi is someone who explained the scriptures, was sort of like a preacher, whereas the priest made sacrifice on behalf of the people to Almighty God. But the Old Testament priesthood, it was symbolic. The New Testament priesthood, based on Christ, is it is offering up Jesus himself, all right, to God the Father on behalf of the people. It's not a continuous repetition, it is the one and the same. This idea that sacrifice crept in, I heard that when I was in the seminary. Some crackpot nun was trying to tell us that sacrifice was an alien idea. And she was in the community, the Precious Blood nuns. Well, hello, the Precious Blood, why is it precious? Because Jesus sacrificed his blood for us. Her whole order was based on that concept. So yes, the sacrificial nature is part of the priesthood. It is not the only part. It is a very important, it's a necessary part. But as Pope Benedict points out, there's that other dimension that goes hand in hand with it.
Be sure to check out Take Two with Jerry and Debbie tomorrow at noon Eastern. It's one of their most popular topics. Tell us your best clean joke. Lines will be packed tomorrow, so get in early. Take Two with Jerry and Debbie tomorrow at noon Eastern right here on EWTN Radio. You know, Dr. David Anders is a vegan, and his Ooh. Favorite clean joke is, why did the vegan cross the road?
Why?
To tell you he was a vegan.
Okay.
So that's Dr. Anders.
Definitely not
joke.
Italian.
Next up is Denise, a first-time caller in Grand Rapids, Michigan, listening on our great affiliate there, Holy Family Radio. Denise, you're on with Father Trigilio.
Good afternoon, Father and everybody. How are you?
Doing fine. Thanks for calling.
I have a question. I was listening to the radio, and there was a nun that was on who said that nobody to distribute communion in the Catholic Church except for the priest. And we have many Eucharistic ministers in our church. What do you think of that?
Well, I think we need to be precise, and because it's not this complete either-or. The church allows for, in certain circumstances, the lay to distribute Holy Communion, and they're given the title Extraordinary Ministers of Holy Communion, only when there's not enough priests to do that. It's not just to be convenient. It's not just because you want to get as many people involved in the sanctuary as possible. It is a provision. It's not done in the Eastern Church, the Byzantine Church, the Eastern Catholic Church. The Orthodox certainly don't have laity giving out communion. Not even the deacons do in that tradition. But in the Latin Rite, it is permitted. One must be delegated by the bishop or on a case-for-case basis by the pastor. But it's not something that you should just plan on, and I think too many priests use it too indiscriminately. And we say, well, we got people assigned. Well, no, it should be that they're filling in because there's just too many people at that Mass, and Father cannot do this by himself. Now, there's other priests. Over, I've been to a number of parishes when Father Briganti was pastor in Flemington, New Jersey. He had all the priests come over, all the deacons come over, and help with communion. So maybe we had no lay extraordinary minister of Holy Communion, or maybe we had one at any particular day, because the clergy, who are the ordinary ministers of Holy Communion, were there. Now, if Father's all by himself, I was a pastor all by myself with two parishes for 16 years. Yeah, I needed the help when the deacons weren't there, so it was done properly. So you want to avoid the two extremes of using them, overusing them, and saying they're not allowed. They are allowed when it's done properly. But again, the extraordinary doesn't mean special. Extraordinary means out of the ordinary, that the normal, ordinary ministers are unavailable.
Back to the Republic of Texas we go. John is in Houston listening on Guadalupe Radio. John, you're on with Father John Trujillo.
Hello, Father Trujillo. I had a question. And marriage in the Catholic Church is forever, but then the Protestants, do they understand it's like you can get married and get divorced? And then also I wondered why Catholic Bibles are bigger than Protestant Bibles.
Okay, doubleheader here. the Catholic Bibles are larger because we're the original. We were here before the Protestants. Martin Luther was a Catholic Augustinian monk and then started Protestantism. And at the time of Martin Luther, there was for 1,500 years, there were 46 books in the Old Testament, and those seven books that are now claimed to be extra, the deuterocanonical books, all right, those seven that are not in the Protestant King James Bible, were not added. They were taken out by Martin Luther and his followers. Those seven books were originally written in Greek because from the time of 250 BC until the time of Christ, there was a whole period where many of the Jews, three-fourths of the world's Jews, did not live in the Holy Land. They lived scattered. It was called the diaspora. So more Jews spoke Greek than Hebrew, and that's why these seven books were written in Greek and then later translated into Hebrew, Latin, and then what we have in our vernacular like English. So those seven books, which, you know, in the Protestant Bible they have 39, we have 46 in the Catholic. We have the same amount of the New Testament, 27. But the Catholic Bible is only seven books larger in the Old Testament because we kept what we received. And you look at the Gutenberg Bible, which was printed before the time of Martin Luther, it had those 46 books in there. So we had them. He took them out. It's not a question of the chicken and the egg. This is chronology.
Aaron is watching on YouTube, and he wants to know, how do you explain the difference between a sacrament and a sacramental?
A sacrament was instituted by Christ himself, the seven sacraments. Sacramentals are things that the church created, like rosaries, holy water, scapulars, and so forth. The church created them. The church can suppress them. Sacraments are directly instituted by Christ. We cannot change them. That's why as a priest or a deacon can only use water. You can't use milk to baptize. Pope John Paul the Great made it clear that only baptized men could be ordained. That's a constitutive part of the sacrament that was started by Christ. So we can't mess with them. Whereas with a sacramental, it can be altered in many ways, shapes, and forms.
And also on YouTube, Rita wants to know, my Orthodox friends say their church is the first, and Catholics say theirs is. She's not sure how to defend the latter being Catholic.
Well, ubi Petrus, ibi Ecclesia is an old Latin phrase from St. Ambrose. Where Peter is, there is the church. We in the Catholic Church have the successor of St. Peter, the unbroken line from St. Peter himself, handpicked by Christ, gave him the keys of the kingdom, all the way to Pope Francis. Unbroken line. The Orthodox Church have valid sacraments. Yes, okay, they have valid orders. But they broke from us in the 11th century. They separated from Peter.
Father John, would you leave us with a blessing?
Benedica vos omnipotens Deus, Pater, et Filius, et Spiritus Sanctus. Amen.
Amen. On behalf of our host, Father John Trigilio, our producer, Michael McCall, our call screener, Matt Gubensky, and our social media maven, Mr. Ace McKay today. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Jack Williams, wishing you a great rest of your Monday. We're back at it again tomorrow on EWTN's Open Line Tuesday. We'll be talking faith, family, and fellowship with Father of Mercy, Father Wade Menezes. Until we get together then, God bless.